Guess it's now 4:15. I thank you all for coming. I'm delighted to introduce Brenda Chalfin, who is the director for the Center for African Studies and professor of anthropology at the University of Florida. She's going to be familiar to most of those of you who are Africanists. She's been studying Ghana for many, many years and is particularly a specialist on sovereignty, the state, the ways that neoliberal transformation give rise to a form of kind of global economic interdependence. I'm particularly interested in the work that she's done on logistics and trade that has transformed governance in Ghana. Amongst her many other publications, she's published a couple of books that particularly Neoliberal Frontiers and Ethnography of Sovereignty in West Africa, which I would recommend to anyone who's interested in the power of transnational border regimes and infrastructure. It goes way beyond issues of migration, which is the kind of most focus on border regimes. And she's also published Shea Butter, Republic, State Power, Global Markets, and the Making of an Indigenous Commodity. She's been more recently working on another transnationally crucial issue, which may or may not be related to the talk today, the troubled question of waste and how it's dealt with around the world. She's also, I'm delighted to say, a part of the Scientific Advisory Board of the Cross Locations Project, which most of you here in Helsinki know about, in which role she's been particularly helpful in keeping us in the project on our toes, questioning our assumptions and making highly constructive suggestions as to how we might proceed. One of the worst many side effects of COVID for me has been the fact that we've not been able to bring that advisory board together in Helsinki for over a year. And I really miss that intellectual engagement and hope we'll get it back soon. But in the meantime, I'm really looking forward to this talk. I'm going to hand over to Brenda now, who is presenting us with a seminar wonderfully entitled Taking Arendt to the Toilet, Excursions in Ethnographic Theory. Unless you've changed the title, I'm handing
I have it. Changed the title just a little bit.
Okay.
I thought the theory was just way too abstract for something that is just so visceral and material. So first of all, I'm so pleased to have some time with all of you. It's my morning, it's your afternoon. I really do wish I was in Helsinki with all of you. It's been such a delight and such a great opportunity to be part of Cross Locations and these ongoing conversations as different projects and ideas have unfolded. And I will be reconnecting with all of you next month. Apropos the topic of my paper today, I'm broadcasting from my house in Florida. It's a little drizzly this morning, but the weather is gorgeous. It's in the high 70s and all. So we are enjoying ourselves in Florida, and most of us are vaccinated. Politically, we have a very, I would say, troubled state, but for one reason or another, we've had great access to vaccines. So some of the pall of the pandemic is subsiding for us, and I hope for you as well, so we can reconnect and we can all get back to our lives. So I'm going to share some research today. We're going to talk about Hannah Arendt. We're going to talk about toilets. We're also going to talk about this concept that I'm developing that I call deep domesticity. And this is, I'm trying to get my slides to forward. Let's see how this is going to happen. This is a concept that's grown out of my research. It's grown out of my engagement with Arendt, but it's also something that's helping me reflect on our very situation. So I'll begin with it, and then I want to go back to it at the very end. This idea of deep domesticity, it's all about expanding and extending domestic functions, their operational reach, their significance in our lives, the ways in which domestic operations and practices encroach upon the responsibilities and the functions of the state, the ways in which they may inhabit and incorporate some of the infrastructures of the state, and not just the state in terms of their political dimension, but the ways in which they bring people together and what kinds of communities, what kinds of solidarities, what kinds of recognition. So some of this is about kind of our household political spaces, but it's really far beyond something as bounded as a household. So it's about wrapping up different functions that may be anchored within domestic groups, domestic networks, domestic resources, especially when other sources of authority and support may be inaccessible, unavailable, and really not living up to their own promises. And I talk about this particularly in the case of Ghana's city of Tema. And Tema was built as a planned city at Ghanaian independence right around 1960. Independence was 57. It was a model of independent African promise and prosperity, one of those kind of cities of the future, this kind of beacon, not only for Ghana, but for the continent. And some of the things that I'm finding from my more recent ethnographic research in Ghana is making me kind of reflect back on our situation in the US, and possibly it could be relevant to your experience in Europe as well. So there's a bit of kind of theory from the South and the ways in which kind of Euro-America and Africa kind of evolving towards the same dilemmas in many ways. And my traveling companion on this exploration is Hannah Arendt. And I'm not a political theorist, so any one of you who might be more steeped in political theory and political philosophy, I'm sure will do a deeper and more precise read of Arendt than I am. But I think she's a very important figure to bring into conversations right now in anthropology. Arendt is controversial. For some, she's highly controversial. There are many issues in terms of her treatment of race, her discussion of civil rights issues in the US, people really thought were off the mark. Her discussion of Africa and genocide and ethnocide, also some concern about her biases and her presumptions. Nevertheless, there's been a return to Arendt and an effort to read Arendt kind of against the grain. And there's several reasons why I find Arendt very important these days. Arendt is absolutely steeped in phenomenology, a student of Heidegger. She's really cut from the same cloth as more prominent theorists in anthropological discussions these days, whether it's Ingold, Latour. She's really about things. She's also very much about the public. What is the public? How is the public constituted? Who belongs in the public? How do we experience ourselves as members of the public, and what kind of staying power does that have? She's also very interesting in terms of her handling of the body. And this is also something that's very controversial and it's debated. But Arendt, as I've laid out in this slide, it's really Arendt 101. Her work revolves around three concepts. The central one is the vita activa, which is her whole idea of kind of a compilation of forces, or she says kind of conditions that generate the human experience to be of a certain type. One aspect is the fact that we are embodied creatures and we need to take care of those bodies. Those bodies are part of who we are and how we function and what we can be and what we can be together. So that's really a kind of materialist edge for sure. She also talks a lot about work, and just be aware that her definitions of work and labor, very different from Marx. She talks about work in terms of fabrication, both the act of fabricating and the things that are fabricated. And as she discusses, this artificial world of things. And it's that artificial world of things that provides the armature for human interaction, human interdependence, and provides a space for communication, deliberation, and this all-important idea to her of plurality, which is really about how we can be kind of together and acknowledge one another and acknowledge one another's differences. At the same time, we pursue our own interests. And when all of this happens, and this is a very active idea of politics, it's not so much an institutionalized idea of politics in terms of you have a parliament and you have the individuals who are specialized in a very specialized place. It's that political life can happen through the interactions of people almost everywhere. And that caveat of almost is an interesting place. It's also something that exceeds contemplation. It's not just about thought. It's not just about aspiration and desire. It's all about that give and take, this unquiet, this being in the world with others and with things. So there's a lot of depth here. And as I pose Arendt's kind of materialism or phenomenological approach to politics with someone like Latour, who's also very important for my own work, I think Arendt has an edge because she, for better or worse, is able and ready and willing to make some diagnoses and not just say, oh, everything is political, or every time we assemble, right? This, if you think about Latour, this making things public, these atmospheres of democracy. Is everything an atmosphere of democracy? How do we evaluate what is a more effective, more inclusive, more enduring atmosphere of democracy? What is truly more democratic? And Arendt is ready to make some calls about what matters and what is problematic. And in that way, I feel that she has greater kind of attention to issues of political economy, to issues of inequality. So if any of you are steeped in this literature, you'll know that while anthropology has very much embraced the ontological turn, has embraced actor network theory, et cetera, there are voices, very prominent voices, Kim Fortune, Luc Messier, and others who really are somewhat skeptical of that turn because although it's supposedly about politics, it doesn't always address kind of where power lies. And I think Arendt can speak to that. So one thing that I'm trying to do is kind of work with and against Arendt's ideas. And the work of a whole range of feminist political theorists, including Saila Ben-Habib, who has a book, it's a couple decades old now, The Reluctant Modernism of Hannah Arendt, who's saying we have to kind of ask Arendtian questions, but provide non-Arendtian answers. We need to leave behind the piety. So we have to kind of think with Arendt and think against her. And so that's the kind of project that I'm trying to do because I think there's a lot there. There's a lot of layers. Her work is also very contradictory. There are things that she wants to say. There are things that she's unable to say. There are things that she says, and then she shuts down. And so you have to read Arendt with the sense of that layering and that depth, and really see this work as very transitional in terms of trying to kind of maybe keep one foot in the past and then really think towards a future and think towards a new language for talking about politics. Okay, enough with theory. I am going to test out and kind of work through some of Arendt's ideas in regard to my research experience in the city of Tema. And I think I just told you that I'm finishing a book on this. I've been working on this book for a long time. I'm really trying to climb out of it, but I'm very in deep with it. And I look at the city from a lot of different dimensions. I do want to acknowledge that I have some great archival images here from the Doxiadis Archive in Athens. I was just telling Sarah about this. So Tema was built at the cusp of independence. It was a pet project of Kwame Nkrumah, Ghana's first president. And this city was realized with the assistance of a Greek urban planner, Konstantinos Doxiadis. And Doxiadis is a fascinating figure. He was in charge of Marshall Plan funds and reconstruction in Southern Europe. He was an engineer turned architect. He has a PhD in political philosophy from Berlin that he got prior to the war. So not only is he an architect and a planner, he was a founder of UN Habitat. So he was kind of a man of the hour in the 1960s, building cities all around the world, not just Tema. I just mentioned to Sarah that he also did the master plan for Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. Here's a book about Riyadh. He did the master plan for Islamabad in Pakistan, Dhaka in Bangladesh. There's a town in Massachusetts, Malden, Mass, Easton, PA, as well as this new city, Astra Spirita, in Greece. So there was a common template, which he kind of transported around the world. And there was a lot of enthusiasm about it in Ghana. It was a very interesting urban idea. On the one hand, it was very invested in kind of industrial development, in progress. So the city of Tema is a port city. It's also an industrial city with factory zones. And then it has these expansive and highly planned and highly orchestrated residential areas. So you can see some of these images. That's actually Queen Elizabeth in 1961, looking at the models. Any of you watch The Crown? Is very popular in the US. There's actually an episode where she goes to Ghana. I have pictures of Prince Philip breaking ground with Doxiadis and chiefs in Tema as this new city was built, late 50s and into and through the 1960s, even when there was a coup and Nkrumah was deposed. So let me tell you a little bit about the city and some of the things that interest me in this city. So a lot of my work is about infrastructure, the anthropology of infrastructure and the politics of infrastructure. This is something that I first got into when I was doing my research on maritime frontiers and trade logistics and working in the port of Tema. And it took me a little while to really kind of fully wrap my head around how fantastic a place Tema was as an urban form, because it's a planned city. It's not organic. It's not the same kind of city as Accra or Lagos. And it was planned with a strategy towards kind of national advancement and inclusion. So people from all over the country moved into Tema, looking for work at the port, looking for work in the factories, And we're really invested in this idea of kind of embracing their kind of cosmopolitan future, that they could be citizens of the world by residing in Tema. And Doxiatis' plans allowed for kind of small scale housing that could then be expanded upon as people prospered. And they, the housing within Tema operated on a principle that Menero, who wrote about Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, this was Doxiatis' principle of a kind of urban containment, of giving people nice homes and giving people nice neighborhoods. But there was kind of an underlying ethos that also fit very well with Kwame Nkrumah's strategy and Kwame Nkrumah's kind of walking that very tight line between empowering and inspiring a new citizenry, but also staying in control and having that heavy hand of power, and setting up this industrial town, a working class town, that's also a space where all sorts of labor movements could erupt. And that wasn't something that Nkrumah was ready for. So the convergence of Doxiatis' model, where, and there's lots and lots of discussions, and there's a whole lot that we could say about this. But one of the reasons that the Doxiatis' model traveled so broadly around the world was that in the post-war period, also a period of decolonization, there was tremendous concern about the masses, the kind of unruly masses. So his model of a city was a way to kind of appease and gain kind of the labor power, tap in to the labor power of a new set of citizens without letting things get out of control. And one thing that interests me so much about Tema was its expansive, not just architecture, but infrastructure. These are pictures from the Doxiatis archive. By the way, this one of the women building, I just think is a really a gem, because mostly we have a sense of contractors and larger firms building. And then here you have people who likely came to reside in Tema building. But if you look closely, you have these modest homes. You see things like electrical hookups, water hookups, septic tanks, sewage hookups. So here was a city that was built with all of these firsts of kind of high modernity within West Africa. There was a big hydroelectric facility, roadways, these housing developments, and everything was tied into this massive infrastructural grid, waterworks, power works, and these sewage works. And the sewage works were considered the most ambitious, the most extensive in the subregion at the time. And nowhere else in the West African subregion has there been this effort to build this gravity-driven sewer system where everything will get processed and then it gets dumped into the sea. So individual homes and industrial installations were all linked to these sewage mains that went through pumping stations, and then they were treated and channeled. And this was really considered, you know, a sign of prosperity and modernity, but it was also a mode of appeasement. And here's just some images of this sewage system. And this was the late 1950s, early 1960s. And you'll see there's a housing plan, and every single house, no matter how large or how small, had the same setup, the same exact hardware, same exact organization. So sewage was a way of kind of linking people and equalizing them, but also a way of kind of helping people kind of focus inward, focus on their own home, focus on their family. And this was also tied to another urban strategy that came from Doxiadis, but was again in keeping with some of the ideas of the kind of Nkrumist government of the day. Again, this is around this idea of containment urbanism. Rather than having an urban space with kind of maybe more organically arising central space where people kind of mass in a more spontaneous way. This city, if you see all these circles within circles, the city was formed around these mini publics, these small spaces. There were neighborhoods, they were subdivided and then divided again. And so you have these small commercial zones that were tied to, there would be a school, there would be a playing field. It was a place where people could do some shopping, but there was an effort to keep people from kind of agglomerating where anything could happen. And Jeff Allman, who's a historian of Ghana and has written about kind of Nkrumah strategies, talks about nation building and this undercurrent of kind of bourgeois survival that was there despite Nkrumah socialism. So this is really kind of a hybrid formation. So just trying to think about what are the implications of this? What does this mean now? And what would Arendt think about this, right? Arendt has a certain vision of what is properly political, what is the correct way for society to organize itself politically. So as I said, she recognizes labor, which is her term for talking about the body, but she's incredibly ambivalent about this. A lot of feminist political theorists have written about this. The body needs to be hidden in privacy. You've got to take care of your urgent needs. And then once everyone takes care of their urgent needs, then they could kind of go out and be a public person. So I think Arendt would be pretty excited that everyone had their toilets in the house, kind of undercover, under wraps. But she might be more concerned about these highly orchestrated public spaces, which were only kind of quasi-public spaces. They were more geared to just kind of reproduction of the household, of the family. They really weren't meant for spontaneous or kind of cross-cutting ties. And in fact, one of the first social movements in Tema was the early residents were protesting because there were no houses of worship. There was no place where people could set up churches, which was also kind of a sign of cosmopolitan modernity that many Ghanaians at that time had embraced. They had to meet in schools. So even the populace of Tema at that time was kind of frustrated about the ways in which public life, despite all of the satisfaction, despite all of the amenities, that there was a lot of circumscription of public life. So we have the kind of glory days of Tema's birth in the 1950s and 1960s and all of these aspirations, its infrastructural aspirations. Well, what happens? Soon enough, not even 10 years after the city was built, it just can't contain its population. It can't contain the waste. This system was not big enough. And so starting in the 1970s, 80s, 90s through the present, just a series of breakdowns and a series of kind of quick fixes. Is also the way this is talked about in the work on Tema, in the planning documents for Tema, is that this was kind of a machinic order that was going to be not imposed, but kind of built beneath the city as kind of an engine of the city. And the idea was this was kind of a self-maintaining system. But that wasn't the case. So the World Bank started to come in the 60s and the 70s. And this system really couldn't be maintained. It couldn't sustain the growth of the population. It couldn't sustain all the water that was being used. It couldn't sustain the shutdowns of water. It was just unworkable. Yet people in Tema living there have tried very hard to maintain the system, maintain the sense of propriety and prosperity and all of these things that gave them pride in being both a citizen of the city and kind of a member of this kind of cosmopolitan vanguard within Ghana. So here is, sorry, my reference is upside down for some reason, but 2018 evidence shows that more than half the city residents, the city now has a population of about 300,000. More than half the city residents are not tied to the centralized sewage system. Public toilets are in fact the predominant solution. Some households still have a household-based water closet as in the past, but they have to do a lot of their own work to repair it. A lot of people have put in their own septic tanks, or they get together with neighbors and they repair the old sewage works that the city put in. So instead of this kind of neat, clean, singular system that's kind of tying people together and making, you know, that labor of taking care of all those necessities of the human condition, people have to invest a lot more kind of day to day in making that happen. And what has emerged is a whole variety of what I call excremental alternatives. And I'm also playing a little bit with terms here. We could talk about sanitary infrastructure, sanitary systems, but the whole idea of kind of sanitation is really a colonial construction. I'm not saying that people don't have their own ideas about order and cleanliness and technology, but there are a lot of other ways of thinking about waste. And I think we know full well that even in the US or in Europe, there are lots of new thoughts about waste and compost and recycling rather than the kind of purity and danger rubric that, you know, persisted for really a couple of hundred years at least. So my book is looking at this in four different sections of the city where there are very different kinds of solutions that come up. So Nico just said that he read an article with his students that is on a section of Tema called Mania. And this is where there are old public toilets that were built in a resettlement area, kind of transitional for these indigenous people who had to be, according to this kind of early independence administration, this transitional administration, they needed to be kind of taught to be modern. So there were these public toilets that have now been abandoned and they've been taken over by the community. So that's in Mania. In Tema proper, which is an area that's the heart of the city, these kind of middle-class, upwardly mobile communities that were orchestrated by Doxiadis, you have the remnants of the old household toilets and the old underground sewage systems with the gravity-driven pipes and the mains and the pumping stations, where the residents themselves are trying to work to maintain them with this big back and forth with the municipal waste management division. There's also a fascinating example, which I talk about in an article in the journal Ethnos, where there's a private waste entrepreneur who has taken this wasteland and devised this kind of gigantic public toilet with about 30 plus toilets, male and female, with showers, with a biogas system, with a hostel, with hand dug wells. And so this is kind of a totalizing waste-based settlement that both serves the needs of a highly marginalized underclass. But the person who's behind this, he has particular political designs of his own. He's kind of a sovereign of this area. What I'm going to talk about today is another part of the city, and this is called Ashima. Ashima is an area on the edge of Tema, and this is where the earliest class of workers were actually moved from the core of the city. These were people who were considered northerners or from Nigeria. The idea is that they were outsiders. They didn't deserve to live in the heart of the new city. So they were kind of pushed to its outskirts, but they're really kind of the bedroom community that is the essential labor reserve for the core part of the city, for the port, for the factories, and the whole kind of informal economy. And Ashima has become a very thriving area on its own. Some would argue even, is it part of Tema anymore, because it's become its own municipality. And one way in which Ashima has thrived, despite being sorely neglected by the municipal authority of this larger city of Tema, who was supposed to provide for it, to provide housing, provide sewage, provide sanitation, provide lights, provide all of these amenities, is there was very much a kind of go it alone mentality that we're going to try and figure out how to do it ourselves. And one thing that has happened is these public toilets in private homes. So you see that sign there, modern toilet and shower. These pop up everywhere. There are a couple of hundred of these at least, where people build toilets in their homes or onto their homes. And this is also tied to sanitary legislation in Ghana, different kinds of environmental protection acts where pan latrines or bucket latrines. So if you had an individual house and maybe you weren't on the sewage system didn't reach you or the sewage system broke down, you couldn't just have a bucket latrine where someone would take that night soil and dump it. Those were banned. And so Ashima went kind of from bad to worse, and it was up to the residents to come up with solutions of their own. So I actually worked with an architecture student who made models of some of these systems because they were a little bit hard to discern within kind of the hustle and bustle of the city and a dense urban landscape. So with this image, you can see how there's a residential structure, and then you have a combination of shower stalls on one side and toilet stalls on the other, and those little conical attachments there are all water tanks. So there's kind of an infrastructural order, a large-scale infrastructural order that's anchored in a domestic space. So I'm going to talk more, just kind of drill down and think about what's going on here. Not just how does it function as an infrastructural order, but to get us back to those Arendtian questions. What kind of public space is this? And beyond what kind of public space is this, what kind of political space is this? Is this a political space? Should we talk about this as a political space? Is there a possibility of plurality? Is there a possibility of kind of recognition and participation? Is there a possibility of kind of some self-sustaining urban networking where the failures or the ills or the neglect or the breakdown of the social contract because the polity isn't able or isn't interested in providing. So on the one hand, we can just say, oh, well, these are kind of stopgap measures in sanitation. There are some very compelling questions and debates to be had about the public health value of these facilities. This one that I'm sharing today, it's run by a woman and her family. I call her Lady Di. I call the toilet Lady Di. The facilities are pretty decent. They're tiled. They've got toilet seats. They're clean. They're doors. They're really pretty decent places. This one has about 16 toilets and has about an equal number of shower stalls. And it's run by Di, who is, she's very much a waste entrepreneur. And she has created this domestic-based public toilet enterprise. So I know we have about 10 minutes left. So my questions here, if we're gonna come back to Arendt is a point of orientation. Arendt is somewhat of an anchor, but Arendt is someone whose ideas we want to work with and we want to work against, this kind of pushing and pulling. So on the one hand, these are public enterprises. And Arendt says some really kind of fascinating, very kind of sensitive, insightful, open things about living together in the world and how this world of things relates people and separates them. There are these fabrications. And so this toilet enterprise is one of those fabrications. And I would say that there's even kind of a feminist element here. Arendt talks a lot about homo faber, the man who makes, men who make, man-made things. But this is very much a woman-made enterprise. Yet Arendt has this kind of problem with the body in public, and she's got this problem with this idea of the social. And if any of you have read Arendt, this is something that people debate and trip over, and it's like, what is she really talking about? Arendt is concerned about bodily labors in public, that a preoccupation with the body in public is just a very narrow kind of orientation, that you can't really talk about the civic good. You can't talk about kind of larger, more important issues of collectivity and governance. She's also very concerned about social conformism. And so part of the scourge of the social for her is when everyone is kind of into the same thing. When everyone wants to buy the same thing, when everyone wants to live the same way, when everyone decorates their home in the same way. So she has this thing against housekeeping, that if we all become preoccupied with housekeeping, we stop thinking about one another. We only think about ourselves. So some of the things that we see in this domestic-based public toilet also fall under that category of Arendt's social. So kind of where is it? Can we use this to kind of diagnose its publicness, its political potential, its political limitations? So let's just talk about this toilet and some of the things that happen here. This is the house right next to Di's. So you can see that this is a working class neighborhood. That's a very densely occupied house. There's a cement house, there's a wooden addition. There's no toilet in the house. There's no toilet in many of the houses in the neighborhood. And so people, both working class, middle class, will come and use Di's toilet. So those are some of the showers in the background. And so what I do, this is a big theme of my book. I'm really just gonna be glossing it over it here. What I look at are the different things that the different relationships that I talk about as infrastructural intimacies. These are ways in which the public, these neighbors, these people who pass by, those who don't reside in this house come and inhabit this space. There's kind of a cohabitation that happens. At the same time as this infrastructural apparatus kind of grows in the backyard and the back of Lady Di's house, that infrastructure also creeps into her home. It creeps into the very object of domestic life for her. So it's a certain kind of middle ground that forms. And I look at this in terms of conviviality. And I'm trying to think about this particular kind of conviviality that unfolds in this space. And to what extent is it public? To what extent does it express some kind of plurality? To what extent is a potential for collective action? What kind of potential for collective recognition and empowerment? What happens in these very mundane quotidian spaces? I don't want to force this into, oh, this is political, everything is political. But this has a real public ramifications. This is one of a couple of hundred or more that exist in this corner of Tema. So I talk about several different kinds of living together, of co-recognition, and what I call collaboration going on. I'm going to talk, even as we just wrap up in a couple of minutes, co-laboring, co-living, and co-leisure that all come together within this space. One very critical collaboration is a civic domestic collaboration. So Di, to get this whole apparatus working, she had to get enough water, she had to drill a borehole, she also had to invest in a water purification system. And if you look closely, you're gonna see two things. One, she's installed the water purification system in her old kitchen. So this is part of this creep, this infrastructure that is supposed to serve the public that's in the kind of inner reaches of her home. You'll also see an official from the Waste Management Authority who's helped her make this happen, who's giving her advice, who comes to check in, who comes to use the toilet every once in a while. And he doesn't really have a problem with her doing this. He's actually kind of relieved that here's someone who's providing these services for the population within this part of the city. So I'm talking about it in terms of collaboration, of a civic domestic collaboration, but also in that Latourian idea of a collaboration, that there's a way of, there's a kind of experiment, this is an experimental enterprise, both socially and politically, as well as infrastructurally, of making things work and making things fit. And so there's a whole dimension where Dee and her daughters are always kind of running around and turning one hose off and turning another pump on and making all of these different kind of pieces of this wider apparatus that they've cobbled together, come together and operational. It's also a space of co-living and co-leisure. So Dee and her daughters are relatively well-to-do compared to the neighbors. And they have this big courtyard. There's the office right there. The office leads right into their home. They've got a TV. They've got benches. People sit in the benches, hang out and wait. People sit at the benches to watch TV. Sometimes the neighbors come and they bring their food. Sometimes they come to play games. School kids, some of them have a deal with Dee and her family and the others who work there. Can you put aside a few buckets of water for me? I'm gonna come after school. So there's a way that there's kind of living together and a co-leisure, even in this space that we might think of as kind of soiled and dirty and unpleasant. And there's kind of this marvelous memory that I have of sitting with Dee and her daughters, and the daughter had just come from downtown Accra with all of these baubles that she was going to sell. And she had kind of unpacked all of this costume jewelry. So we're all just there kind of relaxing and enjoying. And maybe on the one hand, these are kind of the small things that aren't kind of abhors that make people too preoccupied with the superficial and the self. But they may also be a way of kind of bringing people together. And I just always laugh to myself about how we were kind of sitting around admiring this jewelry. And there was a guy in the shower and he had a step over us. So there's a way in which people are living together and leisuring together. There's also a form of co-laboring. So Dee and her daughters work here, but they also have hired workers. Now, again, in that crossing the border between the domestic and the public, a space of work and a space of kind of rest and respite and reproduction, the workers also have a bedroom because these toilets operate, you know, very early in the morning, maybe from 4 a.m. to 11 p.m. And so Dee is very involved in kind of instructing and cleaning. And there's also some very distinctive ways in which she entrains the customers to take care of the apparatus with her. Water is really an issue. This is built on a domestic septic tank that only has so much capacity. And so if a toilet usually flushes with 3 or 5 gallons, and you've got several hundred people a day coming in here, it's just going to overload it. And so she takes this very nice purified water from her water purification tanks and machine, and people are instructed how to do this pour flush, where you just take this 1 gallon jug and you flush. So there's a kind of entrainment that's going on of co-laboring. She's not just standing above you. She's a rather well-off person, but she's going to help you and teach you how you can best flush and manage and kind of care for the apparatus. So just to wrap up, what are the political implications of this? Can we see this through an Arendtian lens? What I call deep domesticity, something that works through these relations of infrastructural intimacy. I want to argue that this is a way that the domestic realm absorbs and supplants and encroaches upon public spaces and responsibilities. And even though it fits into this category of the social is kind of Arendt's dumping ground of the aspects of modernity that make her nervous. It's this social that actually, the social, especially the social around the body, it offers the basis of co-recognition, of some kind of collective rights, some kind of collective well-being, and also a social mobility, not just a social mobility for, okay, these are pay-per-use facilities. So it's a small amount. It's probably about a nickel per use. Social mobility and status for the proprietor, but social mobility and status for those who use it. This is a pretty nice facility. You could learn a lot about how people who live well, people who to some extent have made it. This also draws on public resources. It draws on the knowledge and the connections that waste management officials have. And it reorganizes domestic space. It reorganizes domestic activities and domestic priorities. And there is a level of solidarity as this domestic enterprise offers these public goods and services. So there's a whole discussion to have here. There's a new book by the political theorist Bonnie Honig that's called Public Things, Democracy and Disrepair. And she's really returning to Arendt, and she's very preoccupied with infrastructure. She talks about public things that press us into relations with one another, their sites of attachment and meaning. These are part of the complicated affective circuitries of public life. I would say these toilets fit that bill. But there are many public things. Maybe they're more like those mini publics of an old Doxiadis plan. Are they intimate publics? There's also a way that they can be compared to other ways in which waste politics and this kind of excremental politics have been talked about in cities in the global South. So the work of Apaderai, he's written about the idea of deep democracy and this horizon of politics from the urban underclass. His enterprises and his race-based activism that he talks about in Mumbai is much more scaled up, much more highly organized, and much more self-consciously a political movement. This is not a self-conscious political movement. These are forms of day-to-day practice, which as a kind of politics of the ordinary, whether it's Bayat or others, that they kind of actively kind of reconfigure what is public, what is private, how do we act as a public, where do we act as a public or a private. So there's lots to discuss about public things, this idea of deep domesticity and the politics of deep domesticity. And so just to kind of bring us back, I don't know if this is a projection, but I would say we have a pandemic-induced deep domesticity. There are all sorts of infrastructural intimacies, right? You can see my backyard. You can see my house. Can you see my dog? Can you see my husband? If I had kids, you could see my kids. You could hear them. We have other kinds of deep domesticity. I don't know if this is happening in Finland, where kind of domestic life spills out into the public. Yes, under the pandemic, we're all supposed to be kind of inside and huddled together. We bring our work inside. We bring our workmates inside. We bring the work of education inside, where parents are doing a public service. But there are also community refrigerators, community libraries, different ways where there are networks of food exchange. There's a kind of community care that's taking place where the domestic is literally spilling out on the street. You might even say the same thing is going on with, I was in New York recently, and restaurants are kind of spilling out into public space. There's a lot more eating in public. And there's a whole lot of inequality here. There are those who have to move between these domestic zones, the delivery people, the service people. This picture in the corner was just from the New York Times about the title in the style section was WFH, work from home. And it was all about the styles that people are wearing. So here's a teacher in Mumbai who looks to me like she's wearing her pajamas as she teaches. So there's all these different kind of infrastructural intimacies that occur, blurring of the public and private. A lot of these things aren't, would count as a social and really be troubled by them, but it's new kinds of collectivities. There's new kinds of autonomy and self-reliance that happens. And I guess my deeper question is, are we partaking of a wider form of political reconfiguration that we can read from inside a domestic realm? So that's where I'll stop today, and I welcome your comments and feedback.
Thank you very much indeed, Brenda. That was absolutely fascinating. We've already got a couple of questions piling up. I'm going to also take the privilege of my chair position to ask the first one. There's so much in this, and one of the things that I kept on thinking about, one of the first things I saw when I went to Manchester many years ago, so I went to the local Museum of Science and Industry, and they had a huge display of the inventiveness of one Thomas Crapper, who developed the ball cock and the U-bend and various other things, and in the name of popularizing the notion of the installation of toilets inside people's homes, and that was in the 1880s. And so that, you know, it very much resonates with what you're saying here about what some of the purpose of this is. And then a few years ago, there were these kind of crap protests in South Africa. Do you remember those? Where huge amounts of the excrement were sort of dumped on the steps of the Parliament building. And so this is an enormous, enormous issue. Couple of questions before I start. One is so what you're suggesting here is this can't really be, we can't really return to the discussion of public, private, government, and civil society. That somehow civil society falls out of this. And one of the examples that you gave was this chap who is a member of the government who's actually helping along to create this domestic space in a way that the public can have. And so I was sort of wondering about that, and then my mind turned to Airbnb and the work that it's doing and how that might relate very differently to what you're talking about. So my question is, how does this fit with that very old debate about civil society? And the reason I brought up Airbnb is because I was in the West Bank before COVID began, and there was a Bedouin unrecognized village there, which had been razed to the ground, I think 139 times by the time I visited there. And they had set up an Airbnb there so that the place could be actually marked on Google Maps, because Airbnb places appear on Google Maps. And so the whole question of how the domestic spreads into the private sector and then expands into public, which is then somewhat less government state related. I don't know whether that makes sense, but that's my first question.
I can respond to you, or we could take a few questions. What's best?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we could carry on. Then there's first Ilana Gershon, followed by Nico Besnier and Tuomas Tamisto. Ilana.
So thank you for such a thought-provoking talk. I think I'm very lucky. I think my question follows up on Sarah's, so that you can kind of combine them two. But the way I've been thinking throughout that I teach the human condition, but I don't read everybody writing about the human condition. And you have made me realize how much I teach the human condition as an anthropologist. So I teach the human condition as Hannah Arendt developing these ideas of work and labor and the social and the political as an ethnographic understanding of the Greek life, so that the Greeks have this particular problem in which they don't understand how to move away from their own family interests or their own political interests and think about the common good unless they have a particular class structure that enables them to do this, right? And that she's positing this against modernity, the social, right? And so this leads me to think about kind of two ways in which I want to kind of ask the ethnographic question about your material, which is, do Ghanaians have the same ideas of the Greeks of what is work and what is labor? Are they dividing up their understanding of how to become political in the same way? And then the next question is really the civil society question that I've learned to ask, which is, we posit that civil society is a place where people can learn to be political outside of their family interests, like similar to what Hannah Arendt is understanding the Greeks. But very few of us actually ask, what do people say in civil society? What actually is being done in producing the political? And so I actually want to know, what do people say as they hang out in these toilets? And for that point, I also want to say, Jane Goodman has just come out with a new book, which is all about a play about the political things people say in toilets in Algeria. So the book itself isn't, the book itself is asking very different questions, but just to read about the play might be interesting for you. And there's no, and if I don't tell you this, you might never know that the play is set in a toilet, in a public toilet, talking about politics.
I feel that those are a lot of questions. Maybe I should just start with those too.
Yeah,
Because there's a lot there. You both touch on so much. And the point of comparison between these politics, which, you know, are they even politics? You know, there's that question. They're a form of public life, or are they a form of public life? You know, they confuse our categories. They're different from Cape Town, right? They're different from Mumbai, because this kind of scaling up and bringing to the attention of authorities is typically pretty limited. The people that are kind of carving out a space and kind of using it for themselves, that they don't really want that heavy hand of attention, or they feel like it's not forthcoming anyway. So in the core of the city, where there's the more kind of prosperous, upwardly mobile, kind of professional class, they're always kind of knocking on the door of the urban authorities. Like, can't you fix this? Can't you do this for us? Whereas the working class are like, we've had it with you. You're not going to do anything for us. You're just going to come and make us pay. So they're much more ready to be kind of self-sufficient and take those liberties. Okay, where is civil society? Ghanaians are very political, but they're political in this kind of below the radar way. It's not, people don't typically have a lot of, you know, big marches and protests, but every time people get together, whether you're in a bus, or even, as Ilana is saying, you know, at the toilet, people are talking and joking and kind of feeling things out, listening to the radio and commenting on things. And there's a sense of, there may be a sense that the state isn't doing what it could or should, but there's also a sense that people have enough kind of freedom, another Antian concept, and autonomy to kind of do what they want. And so there is a particular way in which kind of Ghanaians are kind of attuned to a neoliberal mentality, right? They like things to be nice. Those who use those toilets, people are pretty discerning. You know, if you have more money, you're gonna go to a place that's cleaner, where you get toilet paper rather than toilet roll. A mother's gonna bring her kids to kind of the cleaner place where they can wash their hands in a sink. Oh, you want to treat yourself well? Well, you'll go where you can get a hot bucket of water for your bath rather than a cold bucket. So there's a sense of different kind of levels of quality here. In terms of chatting, you know, or hanging around, people do all different things. Another one of the toilets that I talk about in this area of Ashima, there are prayer sessions right next to the toilet. So, you know, for Ramadan, people are going to be sitting outside and socializing and chatting, but they're also going to be reading verses from the Quran. So they are places where people congregate. Now, there's definitely all sorts of gender dynamics here, that the men are more likely to congregate outside than inside, ideas of propriety. Alana's question about Ghanaians' ideas about these places. Well, there are a lot of different ideas, because as I've shared my work with different Ghanaian colleagues of mine, some who are more familiar with these urban areas are really interested and really kind of curious and comfortable, but others are very, very offended, because this is, you know, it's like airing dirty laundry and You know, that can't happen in the city of Tema. The city of Tema is, you know, our garden city and our city beautiful. So it really depends where you are in the city. In Mania, where Nico read the article with his class, there's really a self-consciousness about this being kind of our space, that these were built for us, and that they were a way in which not exactly incarcerated, but the way in which people were tied to certain places and they weren't given kind of the full battery of rights that the new citizens of the city should have. And people have kind of taken that over and they don't want to pay the taxes that are being collected. They don't want political party members to take them over. So there's really kind of a self-conscious sense of ownership, and that these are places where outsiders shouldn't come to try and make money. And there's almost a kind of protective sense of them. So those are some of my responses. I'm really, really curious how you teach the human condition, because I think Arendt is kind of coming back into the anthropological kind of toolkit in terms of kind of theory that we can work with, but we all take such different bits and pieces of her. And I have found these feminist critiques, maybe they're kind of reading into her, but they're seeing a lot of layers. And I'm really, really fascinated of kind of how she recognizes and speaks to the body, but then the body has to be kind of pushed out of the way. And there's all sorts of ambivalence there.
Hopefully we might get a chance to have a discussion. There's lots that I want to engage with there, but we've got a list now of people waiting to speak. So Nico Besnier.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much, Brenda. So my question actually follows from Ilana's, and it's about the body in public, and in particular about concerns for dignity and privacy. So like as Ilana asked, how do people talk to each other from one stall to the next? Are you happy to poop? Who are you happy to poop with next door to, and hear their farts? And, you know, I don't want to elaborate too much, but you know what I mean. And so with in particular with respect to gender. So obviously the stalls are separated. But you know, do you meet a woman? Does a man meet a woman going outside the facility? How does that work? And also with respect to social class and ethnicity, probably and religion. You mentioned Muslims. So do Christians? Are Christians happy to poop next to Muslims and vice versa? And with respect to social class, so you know, is the drive to the wish, the desire to have your own facility in your house driven by a concern that you want to do your stuff in private? I wonder if you can elaborate on some of these issues, which are, you know, very ethnographic, very sort of basic.
I'm going to answer Nico's question because he actually asked about five different questions. So the dignity and privacy is so important here. So dignity and privacy is about how you comport yourself, but it's also about how people attend to you. So even if you're you know, shitting in public or doing something in public that's like revealing something very intimate, it's up to the looker not to look, right? That if they are at watching you, that's a sign of their impropriety and not yours. So there's a way in which that's a two-way street. And there's there's kind of a parallel here. This Mukahanti, who's an Indian scholar who writes about toilets, and he also kind of writes against a potterized depiction. He talks about how in India that there's, you know, the pollutedness of the outside is very different from the purity of the inside of the house. And even if you're someone who's very humble, you keep your house very clean and neat and orderly. And in these toilets, okay, so the stall, people do try and keep them clean. They're all different grades. You know, some of it is depending on how much you want to pay, you know, how what's closest to your house, when is the need most urgent. But we all know that, you know, a public toilet can be a mess, but it's more about the public areas, right? Where you wash your hands, is that neatly swept? Is there water running? Is there soap? Is it freshly painted? And so even if the inner stall can be messy, it's that outer aura, right? So, and that's why the proprietors are busy decorating. There can be TVs. That's when they turn into more of a leisure space and more of a public space. So the question of dignity is very important. And that opening slide with, you know, please don't spit. There's a way in which this is also part of this infrastructural intimacy. I talk about it as a kind of interpolation where the proprietors are kind of asking the clients and the customers, you know, I beg you, do not spit. I beg you, please flush, you know, all of these things. And then there's also the kind of usual latrinalia where people are writing, you know, lewd things. So there's a lot of the same things that happen in public toilets everywhere. There is that gender segregation. There's male sides, there's female sides. There's usually an attendant and a cleaner. So they're kind of keeping their eyes out. Some places have these rules of gentility that are posted. So people kind of know the do's and the don'ts. So, you know, that's why I'm considering these kind of undecidable objects with all of those political connotations. So on the one hand, they're open, right? They don't cost very much. So maybe someone doesn't have a particularly beautiful house, but you can afford to take yourself to that upper class toilet and make sure, you know, at the beginning of the day, you get a really nice start, or your kids know where to go, or you send your daughter to go do her homework at the next door neighbor's toilet because it's a proper kind of place and you'll learn good manners there. So there's definitely that mixing and there's that social mobility, but there's also kind of a toilet for every taste, if I can use that term. There's flush, there's squat, there's water, there's, you know, so there's, and you can very often see that from the signage, that if there's a toilet that's more in a Muslim neighborhood, the picture of the woman will not have, you know, an uncovered head. There'll be a headscarf, there'll be a buta. You get your buta full of water rather than the toilet paper. They're mostly squat toilets. Some of them are near mosques. So they're very attuned to the needs of their clientele. So again, oh, maybe these are public, maybe these are collective, maybe there are places for mixing. But on the other hand, maybe there are places where kind of like meets like, and people kind of in their sense of themselves, their kind of core selves and core identities are affirmed by meeting others who hold those same set of core identities. So that's just to address some of your questions about ethnicity and religion. Yeah, so they're very much tied to particular neighborhoods, but people also move, and then they enable that kind of mobility. And also in a settlement like Ashima, which is very mixed because it's a migrant area, you might find yourself living next to someone from a different background, right? And the toilet is where you're kind of, oh, they do the same thing that I do. Or, you know, this is also where you can kind of cross lines in a more, you know, our human sameness, which is also something that Arendt really seemed to take seriously. So I want to just kind of see this as kind of generative of a lot of questions rather than kind of say they're, you know, they fit into this category, they fit into that category.
Thank you. there's again so much there. That answer really reminded me of an MA thesis I read many years ago from the University of the Aegean about public toilets and the way that in some areas they seem to be just nobody's responsibility at all, and in other areas they're pristine. And then the way that places like burger bars and cafes took up the slack where the public toilets were too horrible to visit. And so then you get the kind of complexities of the public-private divide also in terms of how small businesses actually take up that space. Anyway, there's a couple more questions. So next it's Tuomas Tammisto, one of our postdocs.
Hi, thanks. It was a really, really brilliant paper, and so many questions about the incrementality of excrementality. And I'd have I think it was in your book, Neoliberal Frontiers, where you note how, I think, like very correctly, how citizens evaluate the state in terms of the infrastructures, the states, the state in each case provides. And I was wondering about this, like this really fascinating stuff you have on these kind of like semi, or these, yeah, this toilet infrastructures bordering, between the private and public. And I was wondering, what does that, like from that point of view, what does that do to the state with these sorts of infrastructures? And then also from that point of view, what does that do to the position of those private people providing these sorts of infrastructures, like from this sort of state and stateless state-like perspective?
This is quite varied because the different parts of the city have experienced exclusion, neglect, and breakdown in different ways. And that was part of, you know, even the original blueprint of the city had differentiation, although it promised to kind of bring people together through this kind of underground network of sewerage system that was kind of a mode of integration. So on the one hand, there's kind of the keeping up appearances, right? And it's kind of this odd thing because, you know, it's like all of this is underground. Like, how can you keep up appearances? But in Tema, there are these pumping stations, there are these treatment ponds, and, you know, the city's always kind of presenting itself as we have these infrastructural amenities, but they're always breaking down, they're always erupting. And not only do the urban authorities, but residents try really, really hard to keep appearances. And so, you know, there's news blogs about, oh, these pipes broke and you've got feces flooding the market. But Hertzfeld talks about this idea of cultural intimacy, and there's a kind of complicity. So you can talk about this with your neighbor and you can go complain at the public authority, but you don't really want to air your, that kind of urban breakdown, because people think, you know, it reflects poorly on them and it makes their city kind of a sense that it's degraded, whereas this was supposed to be a place of kind of progress and propriety and, you know, living this lovely life in Tema. It's very interesting what it does for the state. And there's this kind of love-hate relationship, even a cat and mouse, between the waste management officials and then these independent kind of sanitary proprietors on the one hand, they're, you know, they're doing the wrong thing and they built an illegal structure and it's not engineered right, but they do depend on them. So this giant apparatus that I call Wastelandia, the proprietor operator has a lot of expertise. And so every once in a while, he gets called upon by the waste management authorities, like, oh, can we borrow your tools? Or, oh, you're going to the UK, can you send us back this or that? So there's also that kind of, you know, another kind of cohabitation, right? So who become, we talked about civil society, but kind of who are these public figures? Are they official? Who are these public service providers? One of the truly most interesting cases is Ashima. So Ashima was kind of the backstage. I think about Tema was a lot like Brasilia, built around the same time, a lot of the same reasons, with the front stage and the backstage. So Ashima is kind of the backstage to the heart of Tema. This is where all the kind of low-level workers, informal laborers were housed. And they really had to get by because they were just truly like treated like crap. And they became very able in terms of fending for themselves. And that's when all these public commercial, private commercial toilets sprung up. There were also these so-called government toilets, but they are appalling. I mean, just talk about squalid. They, you know, stink from a mile away. They've got crap everywhere. They're collapsing in on themselves. You know, and people do whatever they can to stay away from there. And they're also considered places of danger, like who's hanging out there. So these other places, yeah, they may be public too, but these are safe and these are in people's homes. And you can be an upwardly mobile middle-class person. And even people who are really, you know, don't have much income and don't have much sense of permanence in their lives, they'll try to, you know, utilize these toilets on a regular basis, just as part of their own kind of socialization in their own aspirational goals. But in Ashima, once they became, or several years after they became an autonomous municipality, these public toilets, which for a long time were like a great resource for the community and kind of letting the state off the hook, the government was, the people within the municipal administration started to get worried. Like, they're really taking up our space. That if we can't provide proper sanitation for our public, we're gonna lose control of them. So it was almost that mindset of Nkrumah and Doxiadis all over again, that if we want them to be like in our web, there, you know, it's their biopolitics, our web of influence and accountability and control, then we better figure out how they could be tied to our systems. And we don't want people just kind of amassing in their own places. So then there's like huge, huge, not just kind of waste entrepreneurialism in Ghana, but just around the world. So I have a piece that came out recently in Cambridge Journal of Anthropology about a Danish firm that's doing this huge waste to energy project. So now this municipality of Ashima is partnering with all these international groups of trying this newfangled toilet. It only needs 10 square feet. You only need a 50 gallon tank. You can have worms that digest the poop and one cup of water. There are all of these sorts of experiments going on, but that's more about how do we use this technology to kind of reinstate that one-to-one relationship between kind of the governing authority and those who are governed. So the state is really kind of reimagining itself through these technologies. And again, so much of this is implicit in urban plans, whether we talk about, you know, Hausmann in Paris or Elias is talking about this and Laporte in his book, The History of Shit. But in Tema, because it was such kind of an overt part of the city's master plan, that it's really stayed on the surface as a political terrain. So my comparison is with Menero's book, which is on Riyadh. And he felt that in Riyadh, that automobility was really kind of the premise of urban order and urban governance. So that had to do with oil and cars and prosperity. And so he looks at the streets of Riyadh as a place where kind of urban politics happens. And what I'm saying is that because this sewage system was really the site where the government was kind of making the greatest stab at kind of organizing society, it has kind of erupted and stayed there as that kind of terrain of negotiation and expression.
Okay.
Looks like there's one question.
Yes, and we have 1 minute. So if Jeremy, if your question could be very brief and your answer, Brenda, could be very brief.
Okay.
Thank you. I can't hear you, Jeremy.
There we go. Have I unmuted successfully now? Thank you. Yeah, I think this is probably more of a comment. Arendt is also a dear companion for me in my work. So I'm very happy to think of you now, Brenda, as a fellow traveler in these. I think there's probably a good book on Arendt and ethnography in the making somewhere that we will be happy to read at some point. About Arendt, I think that, I mean, your Arendt, or the Arendt that you're evoking here, is very much the Arendt of consociality, of somebody who, in the wake of the Holocaust is trying to imagine how could people engage, confront with one another with mutual respect, with respect to their differences. And she has said somewhere that the greatest political achievement, or maybe she says the most difficult political achievement, is that of creating a singularity out of a plurality. And I think she sees this as difficult, but it also is something worth pursuing. And this idea of a harmonious public space is very central. That's one Arendt. There are other Arendts, but it leads me to taking a agonist sort of take on your story, to think that, you know, what kinds of public are being constituted in these spaces and these interactions that you're describing around this waste entrepreneurship, and above all, to what ends? Because if politics is about ends, as it is for some people, what are the ends to which these publics are, that you're interested in, are being constituted? Is there some sort of a teleology here, or an engagement with the broader? In your answer to Thomas, you started to bring in the different kinds of conflicts and contestations that are between the citizenry and the state around that. And I don't know a great deal about Ghana, but I do know that there's been a lot of contestation about water, privatization of water, the idea about water as a private good. And obviously your waste entrepreneurship cannot happen without water. You mentioned it a number of times. So the question, if there's a question here, is what are the fault lines here in this public space that you're quite in a very consocial kind of a spirit evoking for us, and what kind of politics could follow from this? Sorry, I guess that was actually a question and probably was more than a minute. Sorry, Sarah.
Yes, sorry, Brenda, you have to be okay, because we're gone beyond time, but
okay, this gives me an opportunity not to respond to the question, but I really want to thank you for that question. And this, the larger matter of, you know, must it have an end, or are the means kind of do the means have a politics in their own right? And are the fault lines a self-conscious fault lines, or the fault lines an emergent fault line? So I would say this is more of a politics of emergence. And this is really more about things that people have brought together, not necessarily for political reasons, but it does political work. And so that's where, you know, again, there's just that gray area where I'm talking about this as political, but I really have a big question mark. I kind of wonder how far we can push that. And I think Arendt is kind of loose enough for us. And then I finally want to Thank you for your commentary on Arendt and some of the things that were driving her particular depiction of consociality and how the body, the whole feminist critique of Arendt is, she's, uncomfortable with her identity as a woman in the academy and she wants it to disappear and her sexuality and Heidegger and all of that. This is, do you think that Arendt wants to talk about bathrooms and showers and, those are places where people were gassed. So, there's all of
this. And it's also the 50s in the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where we don't talk about showers and toilets.
Okay. But there's Arendt's ambivalence about the body, like her, because I think there's so much there in terms of she really speaks to it and then shuts it down in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And it's, this goes back to Ilana is kind of really trying to work through some of those layers because there are glimpses and all sorts of possibilities. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you all for this opportunity. Thanks so much for your questions.
Thank you. Great. So much. It was a fantastic session. Really wish that we could have met you in person for it, but we were going to meet you in person anyway at some point. So thank you very, very much. And I hope everybody has a good day for those in the US and a good evening and weekend for those in Finland.